Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome to the stage the president of the New York Public Library, Dr. Paul LeClaire.
Well, maybe you can have it later. That is the best dessert.
Thank you very, very much.
Hello, sweetie.
Thank you, and good afternoon, and welcome on behalf of Katie Marin, our wonderful chairman of the Board of Trustees, and all of our trustees and staff. Welcome to the 28th annual lunch, spring lunch at the library, in the Celeste Bartos Forum and in the Stephen A. Schwarzman building. Mr. Schwarzman is here this afternoon, and Steve, thank you. He's with his wife, Christine, and daughter, Zibby. I have two jobs this afternoon. First, to thank lots and lots of folks who deserve infinite thanks for what they do for the library. And then to just say a couple of words about the library today, and finally to introduce Adam Gopnik, who is moderating this afternoon's discussion. But first, the thanks, which are really, really important. Let me begin by thanking the co-chairs of this year's Spring Lunch at the Library, Joan Hardy Clark and Calvin Trillin, both trustees of the library, joined by Liz Peek and Lee Brokaw. And we would like all of them to stand and be recognized by us this afternoon. Thank you very, very much. So Joan and Calvin and Liz and Lee, thank you very, 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 very much. I would also like to thank the corporate sponsor of our hugely successful lunch this year, and that is Saks Fifth Avenue, that have been immensely generous to us. The board director, Margaret Kondracki. The chairman and CEO of Saks, Steven Sadoff, and his wife, Karen, who's representing the family and Saks this afternoon. Thank you, Karen, so much. I'm also very, very happy to thank our Spring Luncheon Steering Committee and our Publishers and Literary Committee for the wonderful insights and leadership that they brought to this event. I'd like to thank, in addition, Simon and Schuster for the design of our invitation and our program for free. I'd like to give warm, warm thanks to Kathy Rayner, trustee of the library, for having provided again this year spectacular floral arrangements and decor for the library. Another magnificent gift from a wonderful, wonderful person. Thank you, Kathy. And now, just a parenthesis, you know, ordinarily when one begins a program, one is supposed to say, please turn off your cell phones and other kinds of devices. I'm not going to say that, but what I am going to say is that the toys, this is serious, the toys on the tables are from the private collection of Susan Miller Smith, and they've been loaned to us today, and I think that in addition to being grateful to Susan Miller Smith, it would be really wonderful if they all went back to her. So, Kathy, will you say thank you to Susan for doing this for us? We'll ensure a safe return for her things. Finally, let me thank every single woman. Let me thank every single woman and the occasional man in this room for contributing so magnificently to the success of this luncheon. We have broken all records. We have raised over $450,000 in this tough economic climate. And that's due to you and your generosity. And on behalf of all of us who work at the library and love it so much and know how important we are to the people of New York, thank you for being so enormously generous to us today. These days, lots and lots of people are paying attention to numbers. Ordinarily, customarily, people are paying attention to the numbers that are coming out of Wall Street. Go up, they go down, and they're important to all of us. But there's one set of numbers that aren't talked about enough, I think, and I'll just take a moment to tell you about them. Those are the numbers of people who are coming to the New York Public Library for help in all different kinds of ways. More people are coming to the library now than ever before in its history. And if anyone is laboring under the illusion that libraries are not relevant, these numbers prove how totally important we are, how centrally significant we are to the welfare of our city. Attendance is up by 12%. Loans are up on average by 17%. In the borough of the Bronx, loans are up by 30%. attendance at programs of all various kinds are up by about 36%. So we expect fully 15 million physical visits to the 91 libraries that make up the New York Public Library system this year. And many people who come to us are coming for help in repositioning themselves in this tough economy. Every single one of our libraries has one or more specially trained librarians to help people in job search, to help people write a resume, to help people prepare for an interview, to help people look through all kinds of advanced databases, or rather simple databases, depending on the level of job they're looking for, to help them find a job online. So this place counts. This place really, really counts, and you count to us as private sector supporters, because what we receive from the private sector fuels the collections and many of the services that we offer to the public, who now need them more than ever. The inspiration for the theme of this afternoon's lunch derives from an article that many of you have no doubt read in The New Yorker about a year and a half ago, and it certainly inspired Joan Hardy Clark to come up with the notion of children's literature for the central focus of the discussion that will take place this afternoon. What's important to note is that children's librarianship and their very notion of dedicated space in libraries for children began with the New York Public Library with a wonderful, but apparently according to the article, pretty tough woman named Ann Carroll Moore. And so we are the wellspring of children's librarianship in all of North America, and indeed I think in the world. What's relevant also is the fact that we have a brand new children's room just outside this door to the left. Please stop to see it before you leave. It's absolutely magnificent. It's so successful, actually, that now one out of every 10 people coming into this building is coming for the children's room. So it's the first time that we've had children and strollers in the building since 1970. It's wonderful to have them here, and it's wonderful to have all of you here as well. And now let me introduce Adam Gopnik, a super special friend of ours at the library, a writer whom we admire enormously, who himself will introduce the panel. Adam Gopnik, as I think you all know, is a staff writer at The New Yorker, where he's been thrilling us all with his extraordinary insights and exquisite prose since 1987. He has won not one, but three National Magazine Awards. He has also won the George Polk Award for his Paris Journal series, in The New Yorker that were, as you know, collected into his best-selling book, Paris to the Moon. Adam is also the author of Through the Children's Gate and the children's novel, The King of the Window, which will soon have its sequel published, and it is entitled The Steps Across the Water. Ladies and gentlemen, please welcome one of the great writers in America, one of the great New Yorkers, one of the great writers for The New Yorker, and a great friend of the New York Public Library, Adam Gopnik.
And thank you all so very much for being here. I have been looking forward to this keenly for 6 months, so much so that Salman Rushdie and I both flew back from London yesterday afternoon and discovered each other clinging to the tail of a British Airways plane late yesterday night. Children's literature is one of the great subjects in the world's literature. It is a beginning, certainly, the first place as readers where we discover the possibilities of language and imagination. But it isn't merely a beginning. It is also an end in itself. I was looking at the wonderful science website, Edge, the other day, and people were asked to name their favorite book. And by a clear majority, Lewis Carroll's Alice books were the central books in the lives of the majority of the scientists who were writing. I've just finished a book about Darwin and Lincoln, called Angels and Ages. And the first signed edition, the first signed copy of On the Origin of Species was sent by Charles Darwin, not to T.H. Huxley, but to Charles Kingsley, who was Queen Victoria's chaplain, a very peculiar man in his own right, who turned it into that great classic of children's literature, The Water Babies, which remains to this day not only one of the most beautiful of Victorian children's books, but also the most complicated Christian response to the theory of evolution by natural selection that's ever been written. That's the kind of possibility that we find in children's literature. I am unbelievably pleased to have the writers we have up here with us today. There are two enormously distinguished pros and two wonderfully opportunistic amateurs. who will be up here. And what I think all of us share is the sense that children's literature, writing fables for children, isn't an indulgence in any way, not a cadet branch of literature, not a beginning branch of literature, but an essential part of it. We find in fable and fantasy, I think, essential truths and phases that are often obscured or elided in larger in our grown-up work. Someone said once that the turn in the literature of the last couple of decades towards history and memoir and our love for those things is in part a turn towards narrative. We love stories and we find often in history and memoir the kinds of acute narrative energies that we sometimes find lacking elsewhere in our literature. And it seems to me in the same way that the turn towards children's literature, the turn towards understanding and valuing it properly, as in the work of our two pros, or the reasons that writers like Salman and myself have turned towards it, is that when we write it, we turn towards enduring truths. Not that we don't have them elsewhere or deeply in our literature, but there are certain kinds of eager, simple truths of morality, the truths about curiosity and adventure and the joys of risk that are better articulated in the literature of fable and fantasy for children than anywhere else. In our fables for children, it's not that we have simple morals. It's not that we have simplistic or too easy ideas. But on the contrary, it's the place where we can get the ambiguities of life distilled in their purest colors. Where the place where the relationship, whether it's in Alice or Haroon in A Sea of Stories, or in the boys in Jumanji, it's the place where the necessary equilibrium between anarchy and order is reestablished again and again. To talk about that, as I say, we have three remarkable guests, and they will be sitting, and I will introduce them in order of row. In the farthest seat, one of the most distinguished novelists in the world. Mythological for his courage, he is also legendary for the enormous wit and expansiveness of his writing. He is the only reason I have ever impressed my son Luke, who was reading Haroon in the Sea of Stories, Salman Rushdie's extraordinary children's book. And when I said, you know, I know him, you've actually met him, he looked at me with wide-eyed wonder that his father actually had an accomplishment to his record. Salman Rushdie. Here, Marianne Hoberman, the poet laureate, the children's poet laureate of the United States, has written more than 45 books, some in prose, but almost all in poetry. I won't begin to catalog them all. I will only say that you know, if you have a child under the age of 10, that they are aware of two poets, and they are not Shakespeare and Shelley, they are Shel Silverstein and Marianne Hoberman. And finally, right beside me, a man whose my admiration for him, I cannot even begin to quite articulate, Chris von Allsburg. He's familiar to all of you as one of the most inspired and poetic illustrators and writers in America today, the author most famously perhaps of The Polar Express and also of Jumanji and others. For me, his masterpiece is one of the real masterpieces of evocation and narrative and the possibilities of the imagination, The Mysteries of Harris Burdick, a truly perfect book. Would you welcome all three, please? Welcome. Thank you so much all for coming. I was thinking of, when I was reading that the thing on Edge, the science blog, in fact, that our lives are so often are shaped by children's literature. Someone once said of who I know that she'd been searching for the man from The Man with a Thousand Caps her whole life and never found him. Was there, in my own life, certainly the Alice books played that kind of role. I was saying to Chris before that not only did they change my life, I literally cannot recall a time when I had not read the Alice books. Mm-hmm. They're not, I just don't remember reading them. Can't remember not reading them, not having them part of the DNA of my life. Did each of you have a book of anything like that that altered you, changed you, both as to write as we do now and to?
I did. I know Chris said he was going to think about it.
He was going to punt, right.
I don't have to think about it. And it's the same as you, Adam. It goes back to beyond memory. And it's fairy tales. And it's specific fairy tale books, three of them. I still own them. One of them, Told Again, by Walter de la Mare, these wonderful late Victorian black silhouette-y kind of drawings. My name is printed in it in very four-year-old kind of, so it does go back that far. I don't remember my mother reading it to me. I don't remember I don't remember when I learned to read. I don't think a four-year-old could have read this book. On the other hand, I don't remember when I didn't know those tales. Another one is Grimm's Fairy Tales, a collection, and the third one is Hans Christian Andersen. And I still have those books on my shelf, and I think when they yell fire, that's what I run for.
The things that you'll say. Salman, was there a book for you?
Well, I mean, actually, I share your relationship with the Alice books, which again, I think are kind of just profoundly influential. As I say, I can't remember a time of not having read them. And in fact, when I wrote Haroon and the Sea of Stories, I was, in a way, you know, Lewis Carroll's example, the example that you could write a book which a child will read with a child's pleasure and which an adult will read with a different kind of pleasure. You know, it was wonderful to see that's how you did it. It's an incredibly short book, Alice. You know, it's very short, and yet it does that effortlessly, and that was very inspiring. And amongst sort of English language books, the other one was, I suppose, the Winnie the Pooh stories, and it was kind of wonderful to discover the animals here, you know? And now you talk about how you impress your children. I mean, yes. I remember taking my then much younger son to see the actual toys when the children's library was across the street, and he couldn't believe it, that there they were, these actual creatures who were the creatures of imagination.
And which character did you identify with?
Pooh Bear.
Pooh Bear. Pooh Bear inside. Kristen, did you have?
You were Eeyore? Well, I do have a book that I remember clearly, and I guess because I remember it so clearly, that suggested influenced me. And because I grew up to be an artist, it almost would seem that the answer has some calculation involved, but it was Harold and the Purple Crayon, which is a story about a little boy who gets a purple crayon and is able to create a reality with the crayon. So as a child, that was just incredibly appealing to me, that you could... you could escape your reality by making another one with an artistic instrument. And as I say, that almost sounds like, oh, he's only making that up.
Retrospectively.
Yeah, retrospectively, but no, it's true. I really remember Harold quite clearly making his little sailboat and sailing off, and it just seemed like a fabulous place to be.
And a moment of invention. It's true, I dare say we all edit our key moments a little retrospectively, because I'm sure that I also read the Bobbsey Twins on the 4th of July.
Don't have to talk about our shameful
indulgences. But Salman, you raised something interesting about who we write for, because of course the Pooh books were written in one dimension for a particular kid, and then in another dimension not, as one learned subsequently. Yeah. And I think there's always a tension or a play between writing for a specific child and beginning something for a specific child or children, and then writing more generally for kids. And some of the great writers of children's literature have been notorious misanthropes who don't like care much for children, don't like having them around, but like the idea of writing for an imaginary child better than the ones they know. And other masterpieces of children's literature, like the Alice books, have been written for very specific kids. Yeah. Do you write for a child in mind, or do you write for... I know, Marianne, I believe you started writing for your kids.
I started writing children's things for my kids. I didn't start out to be a children's writer. I don't think anybody did. You know, I go back a long way. And
not so long.
And from the time I was reading those fairy tales, and from the time I saw that with the Hans Christian Andersen ones particularly, that an individual author wrote those, I decided, if he can do it, I can do it. That's what I want to be. But as was the wont in those days, I got married very young to a very young husband back there.
Still here.
Still here, not so young anymore. And had some children at a very young age. And so that my writing, which had been, you know, the usual school newspaper, yearbook, et cetera, sending poems off to the New Yorker in high school. And, yes, I did that too. And anyway, but when I had those little kids, and I was in my early 20s, and so I just started making up little songs and stories for them and put them together into a book. Norman drew the pictures, I sent it off to Little Brown, and they accepted it, and that's how I got started.
You know, you're saying that, Mary, it makes me think, actually, that if you read The New Yorker back in the 1950s, it was filled with light verse.
Absolutely, and that's, yeah, if there had been a market for light verse, a real market, and that's what I do, and that's what I probably would have done.
And in a sense, you and Shel Silverstein and so on have kept alive the tradition of light verse of that kind in directing it to kids.
It certainly has been a blessing to me, because that's the way I write, and to write serious adult poetry in form that way. More is happening now, but that was really not where you could go. But basically, I read that, I was looking up things about both Salman and Chris before this, and both of them say what I say. I wrote for myself. I wrote out of my own childhood, and I wrote from, and I never was thinking. I mean, I made up those verses for the kids, but they were out of my own childhood and out of my own.
Salman, you began Haroon, though, for a specific child, a specific moment.
I wouldn't have done it if it wasn't for a specific child.
Right.
You know, but of course, in the doing of it, you have to find what's pleasing to yourself as well. You know, and I do think. I mean, I now have another 11-year-old, 19 years later. And he's been demanding his own book, so I've almost finished the second one. In fact, I'm going to finish it this week, I think. So that's, we'll see.
Can you give us a glimpse of it in advance?
Well, I mean, it's the same only different, you know. That's to say, 18 years later, Haroon has a younger brother.
Uh-huh.
You know, so it's the same family, but it's a completely different world.
Oh, this sounds just like my new book, actually. It's 12 years later, and he has a little sister.
You know, I mean, when I was writing Haroon, there's a song of Paul Simon's, which is a sort of lullaby, a song called St. Judy's Comet. Mm-hmm. And in the middle of it, he has a line where he says, "If I can't sing my boy to sleep, it makes your famous daddy look so dumb." Mm-hmm. You know, and it seemed to me that's true, isn't it? That what kind of writer are you?
If
you can't write a book for your own child, you know, I mean, that would be a proof of your complete ineptitude.
When you were telling both these stories, well, I have to say, it's when I wrote The King in the Window for my son Luke, actually, and I read him the first chapters of it, and I said, "This is different from all the other stories I've ever told you." It's because I really want to know. You have to say it's boring. You have to say whatever.
Yeah.
You can't. It's not just. You don't have to just listen politely and fall asleep. That's for the publisher to do. But what I want you to do is to respond. And so he listened politely, and then he said, "It's good, Dad. It's good." He said, "Could you just bring the cool bits closer together?"
Yeah.
And I knew just what he meant. He meant leave out all the boring stuff. And so I said to the editors of The New Yorker, "I have solved our editorial problems. All you say to any writer is, it's good. Could you just bring the cool bits closer together?"
It's true.
I had a similar thing.
When I was writing Haroon, after I'd written the first four or five chapters, I showed it to my son and asked him what he thought. And he, again, rather politely said, "Yeah, it's good, Dad." He said, "It's good." Pause, and he said, "Some people might be bored." he said, not me, of course. You know,
Dad. I'm with
so,
it. But.
So I asked him why that was. Through gritted teeth, I asked him, and he gave me the best piece of criticism I've ever received. He said, "It doesn't have enough jump."
Yeah, same thing, yes.
I said, "Jump?" He said, "Yeah, it doesn't have enough jump in it." I said, "I could do jump. You know? Give me that back." And I went away and wrote it, showed it to him again, and I said, "And now?" He said, "Yeah, now it's okay."
It's the same thing, bring the cool bits closer.
Do you remember in Alice in Wonderland, Pictures and Conversation?
Yes, of course.
That's what you need, Pictures and Conversation. The rest is,
Chris, do you write for... Have you ever written for a child, or do you write for the child, or for...
Well, I started writing long before I became a father, so there was not a child in the house. And as years went by and I continued to write children's books, people would come to me and they'd say, "Well, how can you possibly do that without a child around?" Thinking that you needed to have a specimen, you know? And they said, well, even if you don't have your own children, when you finish working on a story, do you get some kids into the house and try it out on
focus
them?
Focus group on them, right?
Focus
right.
group, exactly. And I said, well, no, of course not, because what if they rejected it and had suggestions? Then I'd have to implement them. And it may have been a just reflection of my own kind of sort of lack of conviction in my own storytelling, but the idea of having a 7-year-old come in and quit my work was painful to me. So I was completely isolated from a child's response, except that, and I know all of us here, recall at least one 7-year-old who never leaves the studio, and that's the one we were, So that one's always sort of standing over your shoulder, and so that was the 7-year-old that I read my stuff to. It was the 7-year-old version of me, and so I never, never did focus groups, and finally became a father, and found that my children had mixed reactions to my work. They liked some of it, and found others kind of boring.
I'm impressed that they read it. I mean, my sons don't read my books.
Even the ones you write for them,
books,
or the
grown-up ones?
They're tough.
No, they say they've read a lot of first chapters.
They haven't read them, but in a sense, Salman, I do think that Haroon certainly, I don't know if you would accept this or not, is a kind of allegory of all your work. It's about the value of polyglot storytelling and the absolute evil in it. What's the guy's name? Khatam Shud is
the bad guy.
Silence. The bad guy is silence, and the principle of silencing, and the ideal place, the utopia, is a place where all the stories of the universe run together.
Yeah.
Boy, if I wanted to understand
it worked out like that. But I must say, one of the inspirations I had is I remember when I was very young, when I just started out as a writer, around the time that Midnight's Children wasn't even published, actually, I met the chairman of Jonathan Cape, my publishers in those days, was a man called Tom Mashler. And Tom Mashler's father, Kurt Mashler, had been a great publisher in Germany and then had had to flee the Nazis and so on and ended up in England. And he had published all kinds of very eminent egghead books, but his real passion was to publish children's books. And he, sort of like the Ancient Mariner, would grip you at publishing parties and say in his heavy accent, "You must a children's book write." And at that point, I had a child of about one. And so I said, well, maybe when he grows up a bit, I said, no, he says, "You must a children's book immediately write." And then he told me this story. He said one of his writers in Germany had been this very, very eminent, highbrow author of philosophical tomes and so on, called Erich Kästner. And he had constantly said to Erich Kästner, "You must a children's book write." And he said, finally, to shut me up, he goes away for maybe 1 week, 10 days, he comes back, he says, "Here's the damn book." And he says, "So this book is Emil and the Detectives. It's now a classic of German literature." And he said, "Also, I will say to you, it's the only book of his now in print."
That's a wonderful story.
That's nice.
Yeah.
But so many of the classics have come from people in another field, another discipline. Dodgson again, but also T.H. White, who started off wanting to be a straight novelist, Roald Dahl, so on. We talk about children as though they're a uniform substance, when in fact they change all the time. Marion, you've written a lot, and Chris too, in another way, for small children, for very small children.
Yes.
Does that present other kinds of challenges? Or, I mean, is there a pedagogic impulse? You want to teach or...
That all comes after the fact, kind of, because as we've been saying here, I really truly do write out of my own childhood. I do not write about computers. I do not write about YouTube. I do not, and I would be hard put to tell you what a lot of things are. And so it's worked out really well that I do write for young children, because they don't change, and the kids are, sort of maturing more quickly these days, getting quite sophisticated. They have all kinds of knowledge that we didn't have. The world has changed. So, but childhood and children, early childhood and children, I think pretty much remain the same. And so as I said, I write out of my own childhood. Of course, I have children and grandchildren. I observe what they like, etc.
But basically, every little poem and every story and verse that I've written has a backstory. And I can tell you where I was and what I was thinking of and how I got the inspiration, etc. I hate it when my poems get put into these workbooks for the teachers and everything, and study guides, and there'll be a four-line little verse, and there'll be 2 pages of exposition. But on the other hand, I can give you 2 pages of how
exegesis.
the thing got written.
Can you remember a particular one that you're fond of, that where the
You want me to say one?
Was there a particular one where there was the moment of invention?
Yes. I mean, many, but I just said one the other day, so I'll say that again because I know I have it.
Right.
And a lot of my poems on the page, they look like poetry. I mean, but in my head, they're tunes or chants. Some of them are songs, some of them are. So this is a chant, even though on the page it looks just plain, right? And I remember exactly when I wrote it and where I wrote it. We lived in Cambridge, Mass. We were renting a house on Kirkland Place. It had snowed. Norman had built a sandbox for the children in the backyard. And here's the way this poem goes. And then we started saying it all through their childhoods whenever it was snowing. And then I also say to the kids when I go to schools, etc., listen once, because you can say it. I say it once, and then they'll have it by memory, practically. Snow, snow, lots of snow, everywhere we look and everywhere we go. Snow on the sandbox, snow on the slide, snow on the bicycle left outside, snow on the steps and snow on my feet, snow on the sidewalk, snow on the sidewalk, snow on the sidewalk down the street. Can everybody say it?
I'm sorry, but what was the weather like when you were writing that?
It was really sunny out and about 70 degrees.
Thank you, Marianne. That leads quite naturally, Chris, into what I wanted to ask you about, which was about the origins of Polar Express. That's been a book that's played such an enormous role in the whole American imagination for the last, it's 25 years next year, isn't it?
That's right.
That it's been out. I would suspect way beyond anything you could have imagined when you first thought of it. Or no, you knew that it was that.
Well, no, I didn't know. I mean, I think many authors have fantasies that they don't last very long. But mm-hmm. when an idea takes form, you think this will find a vast mm-hmm. audience. Mm-hmm. This will touch the hearts of everyone who reads it. But you don't entertain that fantasy for very long. But and I'm not sure I did it in the case of the Polar Express. But I've described my creative process with some of my titles, not all of them, but in the case of the Polar Express, like some others, I'm sometimes struck by images in my mind's eye, and these images are vaguely narrative. There's something happening, but there's nothing like a story there. And in the case of the Polar Express, and I can't account for why, but I had in my imagination, in my mind's eye, an image of a train standing perfectly still. Actually, it was in a forest, and it was a small train. It was a train that only had 4 or 5 passenger cars. And it was winter, and the train was perfectly still, and there was steam and vapors surrounding it, and the lights from the passenger windows were illuminating the snow around it. And you could say at that point, well, that's actually just an idea for a picture. But then, in addition to that, I heard this crunch, crunch, crunch of feet approaching the train, and it was a boy in pajamas and a bathrobe making his way toward the train. And at that point, I guess you could say it still is only a picture, except that there are puzzlements there for someone who wants to spend time puzzling it. Why is the train stopped? And who is this boy? And what's special about this train? And so in the case of the Polar Express, I started answering those questions. What was special about that train? And I decided the train can go anywhere the boy wants it to go. And then I asked myself, well, where does he want to go? And it occurred to me, well, it's winter. Maybe it's around Christmas. Where would you like to go if it was, let's say, Christmas Eve? Where would a child about to climb onto a train that could go anywhere in the world want to go on Christmas Eve? And basically at that point, the story was over. Just had to fill in the end of it. And
but it fascinates me, Chris, because that you really work that way, because of course The Mysteries of Harris Burdick, which is such an extraordinary book, is, if I'm sure everyone here has seen it, or if you haven't, you have it on at your table. It's a series of images from stories that are never completely told, of sort of the first magical or evocative image of a story.
Right, right.
Were any of those stories actual stories that you thought of beginning and couldn't find the next part to, like The Boy in the Wood?
Well, I reject the idea that I couldn't, but I didn't take the time
right.
to.
Uh-huh.
I'm sure it's the case with all authors that there are times when you're inhibited because you are, as the word goes, blocked. Mm-hmm. But there are other times when you're inhibited because you're not blocked, but you have a plentitude of ideas and you can't determine which is the one you should pursue.
Mm-hmm.
Because without pursuing it, or I say by pursuing it, you will have to eliminate the others.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't be sure, maybe that other one that I didn't pursue was better. Mm-hmm. So I had this idea about Harris Burdick, and there are 14 stories there, but the great thing was that I didn't have to pick.
Mm-hmm.
I just had these 14 ideas about stories, and instead I planted them as seeds for children to harvest.
And they do. It's one of them. It works. It's like the Joseph Cornell boxes. It works like magic.
It's a magic book. Whoever doesn't know that book,
in every way. One of the things I love in Polar Express and think gives it its special tone is that when he gets to the North Pole, it's not an entirely jolly place. It has a kind of it's a serious place of work, or seems to be.
Well, I have a theory about fantasy, and that is that fantasy should be subject to logic. Because if you simply fantasize and you make things up and you create things that essentially serve the plot, it ends up feeling very arbitrary. And once a story feels arbitrary and the sequence of things you encounter seems to be no more than inventions of the author, then you lose interest. It doesn't engage anymore. So I felt in the case of the Polar Express that I would subject this mythological idea, which has been considered many times, to a slightly more rigorous logic. So I thought, well, if you create every toy in the world for a children who's going to find a gift under the tree, it can't possibly be produced in a tiny little chalet with a couple dozen elves. And so I imagined, well, how vast would it have to be? It would have to be, you know, extraordinarily large. And I assumed that since, you know, he's been making the trip quite a while, it would be older mill-like brick building. So, you know, in some ways people say, well, that's an act of invention, but it's not an act of invention. It's simply reasonable.
It's an act of logic.
It's problem solving. Okay, mm-hmm. What's the problem? They got to make all these toys. What would it look like? Well, it's got to look like that.
And it ends up looking more like Buffalo or Rochester than like the
No, well, I live in an older mill town, Providence, Rhode Island, so there's these old brick mills, and so it looks like that,
wonderful. Salman, isn't that a sort of a central rule for any kind of narrative, though, that it's an act of logic or an act of imagination made to look like an act of logic?
Yeah, I mean, I think, it solves almost all the problems of writing to ask yourself how something happens. You know, in a way, the why questions answer themselves if you can solve the how questions. You know, So when you're writing, you start to say, how would this go? If this were to happen, how would it go? And that gives you your story, you know? And as I say, the why sort of emerges out of that. So, I mean, the thing about the Sea of Stories, for instance, was it came out of, first of all, there is a book, a sort of equivalent of the Arabian Nights, an Indian Sanskrit language compendium, Kashmiri, actually, which is called the Ocean of the Sea of Stories, the Ocean of the Streams of Story, Katha Sarit Sagar, Katha Story, Sarit Streams, Sagar Ocean, the Story Stream Ocean. And it's actually much longer than the Arabian Nights, and it's full of these stories. So that's one of that's where I got the idea, just pinch the title and make it real, supposing there actually was one. you know, mm-hmm. instead of it just being a title of a book. Supposing mm-hmm. there was like, what would that ocean be like? Mm-hmm. If the stories were in liquid form, what would that mean? You know, what would they be? Then they could presumably combine with other stories and become other stories and so on. So it suddenly, I thought, just the practical working out how such a story ocean would function, you know, actually gave me a lot of the pleasure of the book, really. So, and then I, the other thing it came from was that I used to tell my son stories when he was in the bath.
Oh, so you had the
So there was a little sea down there. And I would have this thing where I would take a mug of water out of the bath and pretend to sip it and tell him the story. It came to mind, you know, so...
Merely pretend? What kind of...
What I mean is there wasn't really a story in the bath.
Oh, I see.
But again, it was just that kind of practical. If you're going to consume the stories in the sea of stories, how would you experience them? You know, you would obviously have to drink them. So then how do you get the story out in such a way that it's only that story and it's not mixed up with the story next door and so on? So all these very practical how questions, you know, which actually become how you tell the story of the book.
The mechanics of the storytelling become...
And I think, you know, the thing I didn't say at the very beginning when you asked about books that were influential is, of course, I think probably the most influential books on me and certainly on that book are the Arabian Nights stories. And one of the things about growing up with that tradition of wonderful tale.
What language did you
read? Well, English, but also I was told them orally, you know, in Urdu and as well, and so. And then you can get them in children's forms. There are comic book versions, and you know, and as you get older, you can read them in the originals. But just to grow up in a world where you are surrounded by these wonder tales. You know, which can be the Arabian Night stories, the Ocean of the Streams of Story, the Panchatantra animal fables, the various kind of compendiums of heroic narrative that exist in the East. It just tells you a very important thing. It tells you that stories are not true. You know, and that the stuff in these stories never happened and couldn't happen. But so what? and it's a wonderful way, it's a wonderful education, you know, to grow up thinking, we all know that, you know, carpets don't fly, but we also know why they should. Mm-hmm. You know, and actually, I'm just writing a book, the first time in my life, I'm writing a book that actually contains, as a major character, a flying carpet.
In this new one.
And I can't tell you how much fun it is. Because again, practical questions. You know, if a carpet flies, what's it like to stand on it? I mean, is it smooth, or is it affected by air turbulence? What happens if it rains? Do you get wet? You know, or are you in some sort of magic bubble? You know, all these things. There's a famous flying carpet, which King Solomon was believed to have had. And according to legend, this carpet could grow or shrink. So it could, at its largest, be 60 miles square. And you could carry armies around on it, you know. Gave him an unfair advantage when going into battle. But so there are, you know, once you know about actual flying carpets that, and again, subject to rules, it couldn't be 61 miles, you know. That just gives you wonderful freedom. The rules, oddly, give you the freedom, you know.
Well, it's like Robert Frost, right? Writing free verse is like playing tennis without a net. Mm-hmm. That's my motto. It isn't everybody's, but...
There's also the joy of making the magical mundane in that way, isn't there, too? That is to say, if you were in a universe with flying carpets would not be... sensational. They would be like the British Air flight we took. People would have to deal with them in a regular way. There would be all the flying carpet collisions and flying carpet failures of.
And there'd have to be safety measures. Safety measures, because I mean, obviously, what happens if you get too close to the edge of the flying carpet? It's dangerous. You know? So the carpet has to protect you by curling up to make sure that you can't fall off the edge.
But isn't just the opposite true? I mean, and kids believe, you know, British Air is pretty. Miraculous too, isn't it? Come on, those airplanes, right?
Compared to,
I still think, what keeps us up? You know. Yeah,
well, I think that's true, but don't you think that generally that the children have an amazing gift of leveling their experience, accepting their experience,
that, sure.
that no
yeah,
matter what
yeah.
you.
But Yeah, I didn't get
that
in
all
my
of
first...
Paris, if you give them Paris, sure. It becomes the crepe stand or the one place
exactly.
where they get,
yeah.
The,
yeah.
that they
right.
focus on particulars yeah. in a way. And they, in an odd way, they demythologize the world in,
yeah.
as much
yeah.
as they.
And it's true. If there were flying carpets, children would immediately accept
them.
Them.
Yes.
Sure, how
yes.
you get from here to there, yeah. you get on that carpet,
yeah.
it takes you over there.
There you go.
And, I wanted to ask something about adaptation. You've both. I know Saman and Kristen, you too, Marion, to some degree, have been involved with seeing your work adapted for the movies, for the stage.
Not movies.
But for
yeah,
opera,
yeah.
for musical, and all of those ways, too. How painful is that? How difficult is that? How easy is it?
Well, it's I think in the world of publishing, or at least from the author's point of view, and I'm sure the publishers do, it represents a kind of jackpot.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you know, sometimes you'll read about an author who's just published a book, and it may be more like a profile of the author rather than a review of the book, but they'll talk about the author's triumph and the first printing and the fabulous reviews and the great reception of the book, but they will save for the end of this profile the very best news of all, that the book has just been optioned. You know, and then people say, oh, this is fabulous.
Right.
What most people don't appreciate, that it's only about, I think, one of 30 option projects that become a film. So if you know that going in and a film company expresses interest in something you've written and they option it, you can say, well, at least I've attained that kind of level of success. And if you're worried about how bad the movie is going to be, you don't have to worry much because there's not a big chance it will ever be there.
Yours have been.
But it's happened with me. It's happened three times where a project. Well, actually, I have a few projects that are optioned now that may make it to the finish line, may not. But three times that they have, and there's some mixed feelings because initially, when a project is optioned, that's actually the point where you'll have to make a decision about, you know, your courage, your pride, things like that, because. Those will be stripped away. I mean, pride by the process, because there are probably a few authors who can have their work optioned and still maintain a great deal of influence over the finished product. But for the most part, it's not like that because movies are very expensive. They have to move along kind of expeditiously, and they're trying to silence what they think of as irrelevant voices. That would be the voice of the author. And because the author doesn't understand the necessities of cinematic storytelling. So the first time I had a book option, Jumanji, excited about that, and then actually saw some of the solutions that the screenwriters were coming up as a way of expanding the story. We've talked about this earlier. The expression in Hollywood is that you've got a little nugget, a kernel of a story, and everyone agrees that it has promise, it has potential, but it has to be cracked. So you have to crack the story, and that means opening up this little nugget and finding out all the narrative opportunities mm-hmm. that might grow out of that. And as the author of a book that is 32 pages long, half of which are pictures, that means I'm getting paid a lot of money for a 16-page story, and I'm hoping the cracking goes really well. So they tried to crack open Jumanji, but they couldn't. And so finally I stood up, and I said, well, I think there's some chances here. So I wrote a story that expanded to a cinematic length, a feature film story. Studio liked it a lot, and I thought, well, this is really great, because not only are they going to exercise the option, they're going to make the film, they're going to make it with a blueprint that I essentially created, but then they had it rewritten five or six times. And so that high point, and then, so you've taken this little journey, like, oh, this is really great, oh, this is not so great, oh, this really could be super, and goes up and down. So that project turned out to be, in some ways, a disappointment, because the story that I had written for it included a little bit more of the surrealism that I thought mm-hmm. existed in the original, which I think was greatly inspired by my exposure to the Twilight Zone as a mm-hmm. child. But the film was actually made into something much more like an action movie.
Yeah.
Didn't have the peculiar moments of silence that it might have benefited from. But still, I wasn't greatly disappointed because Sometimes studios will take a work that's well known, especially among, you know, a younger audience, and they'll basically just exploit it. They'll make the junkiest thing that you can imagine. They'll be interested in saving money and marketing it quickly and getting a lot of people to see it before word spreads that it's a stinker. But that was not the case with Jumanji. It was a well-made film, thematically not what I'd hoped, or at least tonally not what I'd hoped. And then Polar Express was made, and tonally I probably couldn't have asked for a more faithful interpretation of the book. But when I sat down with the filmmakers, initially, I thought once again they were going to be working on cracking this tiny story kernel open and finding narrative opportunities that were only suggested vaguely on the book page, but could be inferred, could be explored. And I sat down with the director and the screenwriter and the producers, and I had a very elaborate story that had to do with where the conductor came from.
A big backstory.
And I had all these things that were faithful to the tiny train story that was there and the tiny story of this boy's journey, but I had lots of other things that brought in other narrative streams and but were still faithful to the theme of the book. Mm-hmm. And when I got all done thinking what I'd made a fabulous presentation, everyone was going to be on board, and Bob Zemeckis, who was the director, he said, "Jesus, man, you sound like a producer." You know? We're trying to fight off ideas like that. And I said, "Well, you know, I don't care. I mean, the goal here should not be to make something that's absolutely faithful to the book. It should be to make something that's an excellent film. And if it subsumes the book idea and is faithful to its values, I'm open-minded." But they said, "Well, we just want to make the book." And I said, "Well, that's great, but it's got to be more than 12 minutes." They said, "We got it handled." So they did, and it's a film that's very faithful to the book, tonally, thematically, but didn't take the opportunities I thought could have been taken. But once again, I was the beneficiary of a serious group of filmmakers, a studio that spent an enormous amount of money, what was then a cutting-edge technology. Mm-hmm. And then a few years later, had a third film made, which basically I had the same feelings about. It wasn't the thing I made, but I didn't feel victimized.
Mm-hmm. That has, and it has nice moments that do come out of your imagination, Zathura.
Zathura, the idea of being
the game and the
game and being subject to the premise of Jumanji was the security of the home disrupted by the danger and
the anarchy of the
animals. But then I decided, well, I would keep the house intact, but stick it in a dangerous setting, which was, you know, zero gravity in outer space. So it was just kind of flipping the idea around. But I thought the film captured effectively some of the same points I was trying to make in the book.
The aliens and so on. Significant silences. That's a lovely idea in your work and in that. Someone, you've had Haroon adapted for stage and opera and ice ballet and every other.
Exactly, yes, the rollerblade version. No, it was wonderfully done on stage at the National Theatre in London. A very low-tech production, you know, where people waving strips of fabric around created an ocean, but actually it was wonderful for that because it became in the audience's imagination as much as on the stage. And they did a wonderful thing. All the actors learned magic tricks during the course of the, not for any reason, it's just kind of, during the course of the play, over in the corner, somebody would be doing a magic trick, you know, at the audience. And so there was just magic on the stage everywhere. And we brought in a magician to teach the cast this, and we all had to take an oath of secrecy, you know, so that he wasn't thrown out of the magic circle afterwards. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for instance, I now can do a trick where you take a jug, see-through jug, and actually, you need two jugs. You need two jugs. And in the two jugs, one is empty, and the other contains a liquid of a particular color, let's say green. And you pour the water from one jug into the other jug, and as it fills up the other jug, it's a different color. As it fills up red after having, so that's the first, right? So then you put down the empty jug, now you've got a jug of red water. You go like this, and you turn it upside down, and you pull fabric out of it. And there's absolutely that. I could do that trick.
So the death of publishing, the death of publishing holds no perils for you.
I have a B job. Yeah. So they did that. Then over here in New York, it was done at City Opera as an opera composed by Charles Warren and written wonderful libretto written by James Fenton. It was very funny, and I mean that was fun. It was the music. I think because Warren is very influenced by Schoenberg and so on, the music was perhaps not catchy enough. But it was a pleasurable thing. Now it looks like it might finally get to be a movie, so I'm going to learn about this process of humiliation.
So we have two of the 30. I'm the other 28. In fact, on that thing.
No, it's just been right. Signed up, and I mean again, you know, the pedigree is.
Are you going to write it somehow?
No, because it's going to be written and directed by Alan Parker.
Oh wow, fantastic! Who made Bugsy Malone and
Who made Bugsy Malone and The Commitments and Fame and Evita and.
Fantastic.
So on. And they want to do it as a mixture of live action and CG, I mean, in the kind of way that the Harry Potter movies or the Narnia movies, right? And the producer is the guy who produced the Shrek movies, so it has a sort of reasonable chance it has a reasonable chance of happening, you know, when you have the man who's just made, right, like $2 billion, you know, with the first two Shrek films, right, and a director with the track record of Alan Parker, and they were actually surprisingly nice to me. This may not last. But there was a moment where I had dinner with them, and I said to Mr. Parker, I said, you know, since he always writes all his screenplays, you know, so I said, how long do you think it's going to take you to write the screenplay? And he said, well, maybe 3 months, 4 months, he said, but then you've got to like it, because if you don't like it, I've got to write it again, because we can't make the film if you don't like it. And I said, excuse me? I said, is this a movie conversation we're having?
Have you got that in writing?
No, of course not.
Well, now you can, yeah.
We're coming to an end, I'm afraid. We could go on. I could go on listening for another couple of hours. Let me ask you all one last and quick question, which is, how does the literature, writing, poetry, verse, storytelling, illustration, how do they go on in this world we find ourselves in, where I actually found myself saying to my 14-year-old the other day, would you please get off the damn computer and come watch television with the rest of the family in the rest of the room? How do we compete? How does the image, the word, the verse, how does it go on? What confidence do you have? Where's your optimism? Chris?
Well, been talking about this with various people in publishing recently, and you know the immediate sort of game changer is the Kindle and the Sony Reader, and everyone agrees that I'm happy to report that those things probably won't impact much children's reading of illustrated books, because the size is too small, the format doesn't work, and I don't know if anybody's talked to kids about this, but adult observation suggests that there's a real pleasure that children derive from holding the thing and turning the pages rather than pushing the button. Even though these are kids that will grow up pushing buttons to accomplish just about everything they do, that idea of having something printed on a page is satisfying to them. So maybe my little corner of publishing is not as threatened as others.
Marianne?
Maybe I kind of echo that in a way, because you know, when they ask, someone will ask me, when should we start reading to our child? And I'll say in utero. And I think that rhythm and rhyme and repetition, all the nice things that I utilize in the verse that I write, the sing-songy kind of thing, the chanting, it's not very difficult to get young children to sit down and enjoy that.
So, Mom, will you conclude the afternoon for us? What will keep the sea of stories from drying up?
Well, you know, this may sound foolishly optimistic, but I think there's a sense in which we are hardwired for story, you know, and I think in the way that Steven Pinker talks about language being an instinct, I think that story might be an instinct, you know. If you look at it, it's almost the first thing we do when we come into the world is to want story, you know, and we are the only creature on earth that does this, you know, and I've come to think of the human race as being the storytelling animal. You know, I mean, that's what we do. And it's always been central to the way in which we explain ourselves to each other and the way in which we understand ourselves in ourselves, you know. And given that it's that, you know, from as you say, from in utero, you know, from the very beginning, it's a thing we need. I don't think it's going away. You know,
delighted to hear it. Thank you all three so much. Thank you all for coming. Saman, Marianne, Chris. Thank you.